and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud's going to take us down the road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales from everywhere he went throughout the world of professional wrestling. And before we get there, I want to say thank you to all the listeners of the Studcast, all the fans of the Studcast, because these shows are really growing in popularity, and I know I can speak on behalf of the Tennessee Stud when I say thank you. We really do appreciate the growing popularity and the word of mouth that is spreading about this show. And on that topic, Ron, as we get going here, I want to say a little bit about the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crash Rich, because people have really been going crazy about it. What are your thoughts about it?
Oh, I just loved it. I mean, Tommy, he's not just Wildfire by his own thinking and by his own calling. He's actually Wildfire of the mouth. I mean, he really gets hysterical in this deal. I love him, man. And Johnny is just a Southern gentleman. So, you know, I think it's two different personalities. Hard to believe these guys are cousins, duo Nashville boys, but it was really a ball. I really, really enjoyed number 12. It was a real pleasure doing it.
It certainly was action packed. And of course you can get that at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. More information about that later in the show, but Ron, where are we going today? Where are we starting off?
Well, we're gonna jump into 1974, into a new year, and we're going to it's going to be one of the most important years ever for me. Probably is the most important year ever for me as a wrestler, and I'll be wrestling obviously more of the greats of the past from all over different parts of the country, getting world title shots during 1974. And toward the end of that year, I'm going to make a lifetime-changing decision to start my own wrestling company. So we're going to jump into 74. Today, we're going to talk about several different big-time wrestlers back in the day and matches that I had with them. And I'm really looking forward to it. I think I'm just going to go ahead and roll with it, if you don't mind, my man. I want to start out with my first match of 1974. It was on January 2nd, 2 days into the year. I have a match with Don Carson in Miami. And afterward, I compete in a 14-man battle royal. Lucky enough to win that battle royal and won my match with Carson. And just to give you an idea of how things are happening, 2 days later, I'm on an airplane. I'm flying to St. Louis again for a match with Blackjack Lanza. And for all those fans out there that may not know much about Blackjack, I'm going to introduce you to him, okay? Blackjack Lanza was born in 1935 in Laredo, Texas. He's 6'2", weighed 245. I don't know what he weighs now. I haven't seen Jack in many, many years. But he was a great wrestler and in good shape. He began his career in 1962 working for Vern Gagne in the AWA. That's the American Wrestling Association, obviously. And he teamed up with Bobby Duncombe. And they were managed by Bobby Heenan. Now, there's a couple of Bobbies for you right there, Heenan and Duncombe. And to Heenan, you know, can't say enough about Bobby Heenan as a manager. Obviously, he's gonna really push those guys. He's gonna make winners out of them, and he does just that. They win the AWA World Tag Team Championship on July 23rd, 1976, and then in the 1970s, in this same time frame, Blackjack goes to work for Vince Sr. in WWF. And they team him up with another Blackjack Mulligan, who's a big monster of a dude. And what a great team those two guys made. And they change their names and call them the Blackjacks. I mean, I love that. That's a great little gimmick name right there. You got both those guys are Blackjack Lanza, Blackjack Mulligan. It's a natural fit. Gosh almighty, that's a great team right there. Great talent. And they go on to win the WWF World Tag Team Championship in August of 1975. In 2006, both of the Blackjacks were inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame at the same time in 2006. Next match I'm going to have, I want to discuss, is in St. Louis. And I just said I'm headed to St. Louis anyway. So, I'm going to be in a very rare death match at Kiel Auditorium with Blackjack Lanza. And I'm coming off, we've had a 2 weeks earlier, we had a double DQ finish in which nobody won, and it built toward this death match. Now, it's unusual for Sam Muchnick to allow a death match, but we'll get into exactly how that probably got started in just a few minutes. Actually, I started it, the whole concept, by talking to the booker, who was Pat O'Connor at that time, about a month before this death match. And I suggested to him maybe working a little short program with a return match to see if it would get over, since Sam was just not a fan of return matches. So, you know, Pat really liked the idea. He really quickly grasped the idea I had in mind that I suggested to him. And he said, I'll take a chance with it. And the way he put it, he says, just to see the results. So the results were evident to him, and it was evident to me, and I'm sure it was evident to Blackjack. When we went to the ring, you could just feel the anticipation and excitement in the crowd that they're going to get something. They're getting not only a return match, but they're getting a return death match. And it was a long, grueling match with a lot of falls. I think each of us took several falls. And I finally get the fuller leg lock on him, and he submits, and he can't get back to his feet. It's a death match. There's a 30-second rest period between falls, and in the count of 10, he wasn't able to get to his feet after the 30 seconds. He wasn't able to get to his feet on the 10 count, and I end up winning that. That match, which was perfect, because I'm going to come back 2 weeks later to wrestle Harley Race there. And at the end of the match, I get back to the dressing room, and there's a Pat O'Connor, and he's waiting in my dressing room. He's smiling like a Cheshire cat, man. He was just ecstatic with it. And it turns out that Sam was ecstatic with it as well. And I was a little concerned about that part of it, because I don't know if he really talked much about what he was trying to do here with this death match. But evidently Sam liked it too. And it just really laid a great foundation for me and my relationship with Pat O'Connor, who was letting me do a lot of finishes at that time frame anyway. And now I really had his ear, and he had a lot of confidence in what I was going to say and what I thought was maybe a good idea.
How often were you using the Fuller leg lock at this point in your career?
I was using it quite a bit. And when I started my early part of my career, I used it a lot. Now, as the time went on, I got more popular. I kind of got away from using it as much. I used it in big time events, and I remember when Bob Armstrong was refereeing against me, and when I was wrestling Flair for the World Championship in Mobile, Alabama, and Bob turns on me. I had him in the Fuller leg lock. I had the World Championship. It was won. Nobody ever got out of that hold. Nobody ever failed to submit. And it was just a fantastic move. And And my dad, I got to thank my dad for that. He developed the entire move, and it was just basic wrestling, a basic inside toe hold, but he did it in a beautiful way. And I was able to use it a lot. My brother used it a lot as well.
So last episode, obviously, you were all over the place. You were in various territories. What is your schedule like here at this point in the beginning of 74?
Oh, my gosh. It's just crazy. I mean, this death match just talked about occurred on Friday, January 7th, 1974. And in the next 8 days, I'm going to wrestle in West Palm Beach. I'm going to wrestle in Fort Myers. I'm going to wrestle in Atlanta. And I will be back on the Saturday after Atlanta in St. Louis again on television. So, and, you know, we've talked about it on recent studcasts, how I'm not getting much bookings, many bookings in Florida during this time period. And in fact, I only wrestled 10 times total in the month of January, which is a real small month for me and a great cutback from where I have been. But the big things are starting to happen in the Florida and the Georgia NWA territories. And there's some transitions are being made early in that year that are going to fire up both of these areas. As bookers, the transitions are basically bookers. Bill Watts is going to come into Florida and replace Louis Tillet as the booker in Florida. And Jerry Jarrett is going to go in and replace Bill Watts, who has left Georgia to come to Florida. Business is going to remain very strong in Georgia as we're getting to the winding down the Atlanta Wrestling War. Ann's beginning to lose some of her clout. Some of her talent is beginning to be stale. They're still busting that big time NWA support in there for the company, for Lester and for Watts as well, since he is the booker. And they're going to have a tremendous year in 1974. And Watts is going to come to the Florida territory, and they're going to turn Dusty Rhodes and Dusty Rhodes babyface in 1974. And they're going to have the biggest year in Florida at the box office that they probably ever had in their history.
It definitely points out how important Bill Watts was as a booker at that period of time, because he was the booker and part owner in 73 in Georgia up until Jim Barnett comes in, and then he wasn't until Jim Barnett brought in Jerry Jarrett after that. And then he goes to Florida, and like you said, the biggest year in the history of championship wrestling from Florida.
Yeah, it's amazing. He does a great job. Both of those states and in both of those territories, he goes in and really, really explodes business for him. And Jerry Jarrett's going to come in following him and do a great job for, it's not going to be Lester very much longer. It's going to be for Jim Barnett, who has come out of Australia and is making all the arrangements early in 74 to take over that Georgia territory, buy out both entities, and become the man there in Georgia. And obviously with Ted Turner's TBS station and the cable systems and the satellite, all that, he's going to become a major factor in wrestling, period, but especially in Georgia. So, and speaking of Georgia, you know, I'm going in there on Friday, the 11th of January, to defend my Georgia Heavyweight Championship that I had won 2 weeks earlier from Bill Watts. And I'm going to defend it against Mr. Wrestling Number 2. And I have worked with Johnny Walker, that is Mr. Wrestling Number 2, before he put the mask on, many times in Florida in the previous couple of years, because he had been there in 70, 71, before I guess he started into Georgia. This is the first time I really get to work with him under a mask. And I'm amazed at how different he works with the mask than without it, which is, it really shocks me in a way. He's a heel now. He's been a baby face in Florida for all those years. Now he's a heel. He's got on the mask, and his whole demeanor is different. He's smooth. He's a lot more smooth and confident in the ring. It's like you're not wrestling Johnny Walker. He's a different wrestler than he was without the mask. And he's going to become a superstar when they turn him babyface in Georgia. And that's And that's going to skyrocket business there when they make that turn with him and they make a baby face out of him. He will be monstrous there. And it's kind of funny how a very similar thing is going to happen in Florida about the same time when Dusty Rhodes is going to turn babyface, having been a heel in Florida for many, many years. So, you know, there's two heels there that turned babyface in two different territories in 1974 that just ignite their businesses in both those territories. Pretty darn amazing that that happens.
Are there any other guys you could think of that they had one career without a mask, and then they put on the mask, and it was a whole new career, and it really reignited them?
Oh, geez. Probably, that's a great question, and I'd need to give that a little bit of thought. But it really changes you, and I've worn a mask some myself. Yeah, it rejuvenated my career. Come to think of it, I could probably throw myself in there as an answer because I wrestled as Ron Fuller for many, many years. Then lost Lose to Leave the Town, came back, put the mask on as the Tennessee Stud, and geez, just I felt different. It's something about wearing a mask that just it changes just your psychology, not just your style, but it changes your psychology somewhat, and it can really, really pump you up and make a different wrestler out of you. And I think that's what happened in Wrestling 2's case. So in this match on the 11th of January, 1974, for the Georgia Heavyweight Championship, we have a fantastic match, Wrestling 2 and I, and we go close to an hour, and it ends up something similar to the championship match I had with Bill Watts a couple of weeks earlier than that. Everybody loved the bump that I had improvised with Watts in that title match. And where I scooped him up off of tackle and staggered back, and both of us went over the top rope backwards, upside down. Pretty spectacular bump. Johnny watched that match, and he told me in the dressing room, he said, I want to start the finish with that mat, that move. He goes, that looked absolutely unbelievable. So we worked out to do that. We changed it slightly. And then when I went over, instead of landing on my feet and smashing my head in the apron with Watts, this time I went over and I went back on my back onto the concrete. A little harder bump for me, a little more dangerous for me, but it really was an impressive bump. And obviously I drop him on the apron just like I did with Watts. I'm out on the concrete. We're both selling it, and I get up and crawl back under the bottom rope, and I'm having trouble getting to my feet. And as I crawl back in the ring, he's out on the apron, and he turns his back. The referee's kind of looking at me, kind of checking on me, and he's out there on the apron wrestling too. He goes into his tights. He brings something out. I don't see it. Referee doesn't see it. And once I get to regain my feet, I go for him. He's still on the apron there. I go to get him. I don't see he has something, and he takes a big swing. When he takes the big swing at me, I luckily duck it, and then I just reach over the top rope, and I crotch him between the legs. I pick him up really high as I could pick him up, and I give him a belly-to-back suplex in the ring. But he's still got that gimmick on his hand. And when I've got him up there at the height of it, as high as I can get him, and I go backwards, and I'm about to drop both of us on our heads, he nails me. Going down, he hits me with the gimmick, and he covers me, and the referee counts me out. And rest of that is pretty much history. Wrestling 2 is going to go on to become quite possibly the greatest Georgia heavyweight champion of all time. He was really over there after he turns babyface. I don't know anybody, may never been anybody over in Georgia better than he was at that point.
Was it a relief to you that you wouldn't have to go to Atlanta anymore? Now that you were no longer the champion, your commitments there are over. You can focus on Florida, St. Louis, whatever else.
Yeah, it was a relief because, you know, the traveler was getting, I've talked about it on Studcast, and I even talked about it extensively on a Super Studcast about just wearing out, becoming almost just just burned out totally and almost ready to quit the sport. And it did remove one city that I was going to pretty regularly, and I was having to catch those planes and stay overnight in the hotels and deal with all that travel. And now all of a sudden, I'm basically back to Florida and just St. Louis. I'm still going to be in St. Louis all through 74. Every other week, I'm there for sure. Every time Kiehl's runs, I'm on every one of those shows. So I'm not getting out of it too much. And Watts is going to involve me back into Florida again. Like I said a minute ago, only worked 10 times in January. Louis Tillet is still basically kind of booking, and Watts is starting to take the book over. And Watts makes an adjustment, and he starts to push me again, which I guess that was a really, really nice thing for him to do. And it just helped me to where I got back big in Florida again, as well as in St. Louis at the same time. And things were going pretty darn good for me at that time. Couldn't have been much better.
When we return, we are going to St. Louis for Ron's second world title match with one of the all-time greats, Harley Race. But first, a word about Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy and Johnny Rich.
The Stud takes us on a different ride for each monthly three-hour Super Studcast. The Stud's wrestling companies were famous for making wrestlers feel like they were part of a wrestling family. Southeastern Championship Wrestling in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Pensacola, Florida, Continental, and USA Wrestling were all built around real families as well. The Armstrongs, the Welches, the Goldens, and a third family also played a role in the success of these great wrestling companies. At TN Stud. TNStud.com/studcast. Two cousins from Nashville, Tennessee, set Continental and USA Wrestling on fire, literally. One of these cousins actually used the word to describe himself and became one of the most famous and recognizable athletes of all time in the sport of wrestling. The Stud is honored to have as his special guest on Super Studcast number 12, Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crash Rich. Find out for yourself what it's like to be a wild-eyed Southern boy, as these two great ones tell their story and make this one really super. Saddle up, cinch it up tight, and hold on for this historical and hysterical ride with Tommy Wildfire Rich and Johnny Crash Rich at TNStud.com or Patreon.com/studcast.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 12, a very memorable Super Studcast with Wildfire Tommy Rich as well as Johnny Crash Rich. We find out why exactly his name is Crash on this episode of the Super Studcast, available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Before we went to the break, Ron, we said we were going back to St. Louis.
Yes, we are. Obviously, I win the death match with Black Jack Lanza, and they set me up perfectly to go back and wrestle Harley Race. And this is Harley's home. I don't know if fans worldwide realize, but he's kind of been a Missouri boy, born and raised there. And this wrestling him right there in Kiehl, that's it. It's really you're wrestling a tremendously tough individual, and you're in that big old building, and fans. He's a heel there, but as a world champion, he's not so much a heel anymore. They've kind of gained respect for him now, and he actually he wins that title in Kansas City. So he's a hometown favorite here in a way. He's a tremendous wrestler and a tremendous athlete anyway. And this is going to be my fourth world championship shot. I've had two title matches with Dory Funk Jr. and I've had one with Harley. This is my fourth shot. I've wrestled three other former NWA world champions at this point. I've wrestled Luthez, which that's an all night event right there. Pat O'Connor and Gene Koninsky, in my first 3.5 years in the sport. I'm only 25 years old, and I get to thinking about this when I looked at this particular match. I'm 25 years old, and I've wrestled. There are five world champions at this point, and I'm not exactly sure how that rates with other young wrestlers, but It's kind of a who's who of wrestling that I've wrestled at this point in my life for a 24-year-old guy. I don't know other wrestlers. I can't think of a whole lot of names probably that at 25 years old have had the opportunities at world championship matches that I've had, and to be able to wrestle this type of talent. These guys are just so phenomenal. All of them. That, you know, when you look at that list right there, you got Dory Funk Jr. and Harley Race and Lou Thesz, Pat O'Connor and Gene Kaninsky. I mean, wow, that is a group of real big time veterans, some of the greatest that ever went in the ring.
Compare working with Lou Thesz to working with Gene Kaninsky. What was that like for you?
Well, you know, they got different styles, and that's what's great about the NWA World Champions. They all had a different style, and Lou's style was solid wrestling. He loved that, and he liked to exchange holds, and he wanted to reverse wrist locks, and he overhand wrist locks, and then to a hammerlock, and just he was a chain wrestler is what I call him. He moved like a chain from one link to another, and one move to another. He was so smooth, and he had such skill at his wrestling ability. Gene Kaninsky, he's a big brute of a guy. I mean, he wrestles pretty decently, but that's not his big forte. And it's pretty quickly you realize that when you wrestle him, that you're not going to get a whole lot of wrestling in his match. You're going to have to deal with his strength and with his pounding ability and what he has that makes him who he is. He's going to utilize that, and that's what Thesz does. He utilizes wrestling skill because he was a phenomenal wrestler. And Gene Kaninsky, big hoss of a guy, and he want to beat you down a little bit. He's going to want to get you down and throw you out on the floor and come out on the floor and do things to you. It's a totally different style than Lou. And that's what's intriguing about being a wrestler, and especially when you're wrestling against world champions, is that big difference in the styles that they want. Let me talk a little bit about the incomparable, and I use that term literally, the incomparable Harley Race. I mean, I'm going to dig a little deeper into individuals than I normally do into the history of Harley, because in my estimation, Harley may well be the best that ever lived. His life and wrestling history is the stuff movies are made of. I mean, he dealt with so much negative adversity, and not just in the ring and not to do with the sport, but with things that happened to him in his life. I admired, I respected, and just flat loved Harley Race. And I wasn't the only wrestler that felt that way about Harley. Guys loved Harley. All the wrestlers in the dressing room loved Harley. And they all had a great deal of respect for him. And he was a tough son of a gun. He was not a Lou Thesz when it came to wrestling, but he was so tough in other areas. And his strengths were in areas that other wrestlers just had a tough time dealing with him. His style was so different. He had more guts and intestinal fortitude, as Gordon Sully used to call it, than any guy I think I ever knew. He just never stopped. You could not hurt him, and he couldn't hurt himself. I've seen him do things and get up from the bumps, and I was just like, how can he get on his feet again? Is just really amazing. So just a fabulous thing to be able to work with a guy that's that great an athlete.
How well did you know him? Did you guys have a good relationship?
We had a pretty decent relationship. In the beginning, you know, I was very, very young, obviously, and I didn't get to spend a lot of time with Harley because he's a heel and I'm a babyface. And you know, business was different in those days, and you weren't seen with them. So I rarely got to talk to him other than maybe in dressing rooms, in which two dressing rooms were all together. And he told me a whole lot about himself and the little bit of time I was able to spend with him. Because I ask him questions, what happened here, and how did you get to this point? How did you handle that? And I was a young guy just seeking information like crazy. But I didn't get to spend enough time with him. I wish that I had been a heel and I could have traveled with him on the roads and watched him drink and raise hell, which he was very much famous for. And I've heard all kinds of stories, but I never got to witness that because I couldn't hang out in a bar with him. There wasn't a place that you could spend a lot of time with him. But he told me a whole lot about his life. And that's why I said earlier, it's like his life was the stuff you make movies out of. He's born in 1943, and he's born the son of the sharecroppers. His mom and daddy are we were the poorest of the poor. I mean, he grew up with really nothing. And sharecropping is a strange way to make a living anyway. You live on somebody else's property and you farm that property. And then when you get your crops, instead of being able to keep the money from the sale of it, you basically give them a big percentage for allowing you to use their land. You don't own anything. It goes back to Civil War times and prior to, after the Civil War, that's how a lot of people were able to survive, is they would get on somebody's property and say, let me build a house here, a little hut of some kind, and let me work this land, and I will give you a percentage of what I make at the end of the year. Very, very tough life. To go along with the fact that he comes up in that type of background, he has polio as a child. And I asked him about that, we don't see it anymore. That's a gone disease anymore. And he gets his first win, I think, in my opinion. He defeats and gets his first victory over, I think, one of the worst diseases of the 20th century. People suffered horribly with polio, and he's able to defeat it, to get to where he don't need braces, and he can walk, and he can do everything anybody else can do. And then he says he comes down with cancer. So he's got cancer as a young kid. He's got polio as a young kid. And he fights that battle, that's a huge battle. But he has size. He's lucky, I said, well, if you start out like that, how do you ever get big, And he said he was just lucky. He said as a young teenager, he was bigger than everybody else that was around him. And he had a fight in high school with somebody, a bigger kid, an older kid than he was. I don't know if he was bigger, but he was certainly older than Harley was. And he said that the principal tried to stop the fight, and he ended up kneeing Harley in the back of the head. And it made Harley mad, probably kneed him pretty good, I would think. He's trying to get him off of some kid that's down below him. And I assume Harley's beating the hell out of him. And the principal knees him in the back of the head. And Harley gets up off the guy that he's on, the kid that he's on, and he goes for the principal. And they got to pull Harley off the principal. He said, I had him down and I was doing a number on him. And so they break the fight up, and obviously he gets kicked out of school. He's like the 9th, 10th grade, something like that. So now he's really behind the eight ball. He's got no school to go to. He's living in Missouri, out in the country, obviously. And now he's got his opportunity, and what his future looks like is pretty dim, I'm thinking, at this point. What the hell is he going to do there? Luckily, there's two former wrestlers that are farmers, and they have a farm not too far from where Harley is. And it's two brothers, Stanislaus and Waldak Zabisco. They were both former world champions. Amazing, kind of like the Funks. You know, not in NWA. There is no NWA in this time frame. But, you know, these guys are fabulous wrestlers, and they fall in love with Harley. They like his toughness, which he had plenty of, and they start to train him. I guess they feel sorry for him, maybe. And he said he worked. He would go over and work his butt off. And then sometimes they would take him, and they had a little ring there of their own, and they would take him and work out with him. He said, you know, I asked him, I said, did you ever want to be a wrestler? And he said, hell, I know nothing about wrestling. He didn't have a television. He'd never seen wrestling. You know, he didn't know much about what it was all about or anything else. And they're stretching him, no doubt, and his training. And so they introduce him to a wrestling promoter, St. Joseph, Missouri wrestling promoter named Gus Karras. And he starts he's already learned how to wrestle. They're basically turning him over to Gus now, and they're saying, you know, this kid's young. He's 17 years old. That, to me, just shocked me. He's 17 years old. They turn him over to this promoter named Gus Karras, and they say, this kid's ready to go. And Gus Karras starts booking him against men, you know, at 17 years old. That's just an amazing thing when I think about that.
Who was the person in your family that started wrestling the youngest?
Jeez, I'm thinking Jimmy. Probably Jimmy Golden started younger. I know he was younger than I was. I didn't really start till after college, obviously. Rob started after high school. He was maybe 18. I mean, maybe 20. Jimmy probably started wrestling in the Montgomery area in Louisiana when he was about 18 years old. Pretty much close to the age here that we're talking about for Harley. But that's just really, really tough. It's a tough transition to make. And when you're young like that and you're dealing with men, especially in the sport of wrestling, it's very, very difficult to gain respect that you want to get. So and then I get into a discussion with him one time we're together, and I say, you know, after you started out and you're working for Karras in Missouri, where'd you go? And I never knew this. This shocked me. He says, I went and worked for your grandfather in Nashville, Tennessee, for Roy Welch. I was like, no. You're kidding. And he says, yes. He said, you know, I had the opportunity to go there, and I'd heard that the guys were tough there, and I wanted to be involved with them. I had heard about your grandfather's brother, Herb, world junior heavyweight champion. I'd heard about Roy. And, you know, he really put over Herb and Roy, Lester, all that group of Welches in that first generation. So when he gets there, they change his name. They decide that he's going to be Jack Long, a guy named Jack Long. And they did it because they had a star in the territory at that time named John Long. Called him Johnny Long. So they take a young kid like Harley at this age, and he's 18 years old. They pair him with this veteran guy named John Long, Johnny Long, who is a star. He's already been there in Tennessee in that territory for quite a while. And obviously that's given him a great leg up. I could tell in the conversations when we talked about Roy and what happened in Nashville that he was very respectful of them giving him the opportunity to work as a partner with a real veteran who could teach him the things that he needed to know. And in that territory, Harley won his very first championship. He and Johnny Long win the Southern Tag Team Championship in Tennessee when he's 18 years old. Pretty darned amazing fact right there.
How long did he stay in Nashville?
He stayed in Nashville for a while. He told me he married a Nashville girl. And about 5 weeks after he married the girl, he got a shot working in St. Joe, and he was going to go back. They've been married for 5 weeks. She's pregnant, And he, you know, they, so he wants to take her back, introduce her to his family, the whole deal. And so they going back, they have a car wreck. A horrific car wreck, a terrible, terrible car wreck. As he's returning home to wrestle in St. Joe, it's a big moment for him. It's something he's worked for a long darn time to go back and kind of flaunt how good he is now, and the fact that he has become a wrestler and a bona fide good one at that. And he has this horrible car wreck, so bad that they pronounced both of him and his wife dead on the scene. And then they put them into ambulances to take them to the morgue. They don't even take them to the hospital. They're dead. They think they're dead. And Harley starts to move in the ambulance that he's in, and they realize that he's not dead. Really amazing thing here. I mean, like I say, this guy's life is like a movie, you know. So he's not dead. But his legs, he got a real horrible forearm injury, and his legs are badly hurt, especially one of them. So the leg that's really hurt is so injured that they're going to amputate. They want to amputate his leg, but he's unconscious. When he gets to the hospital, he's unconscious for several days. So he's got a real problem with his forearm. They put a metal rod into his forearm during the time he's unconscious. He has not regained consciousness yet at all. And then they get ready to amputate his leg. And Gus Karras finds out. He doesn't know. I don't think Gus knows here for a couple of days that Harley's that's even been there or in the hospital or whatever. Somehow he tracks down where Harley's at. And when he arrives at the hospital, they're rolling Harley into the operating room to cut off his leg. And Karras just insists. He says, absolutely not. You do not touch his leg. You know, he already sees the arm is already messed up and looks mangled and terrible. And, you know, he just being a friend and being kind of like a father figure to him, because he's still only 18, 19 years old. He's a boy. He's a young man, but kind of basically like a boy. So Karras really takes him under his arm. He says, absolutely not. You're not going to take off his leg. So he's told that. So they operate on him. And gosh, you know, they have to do all kinds of things to his leg. And they tell him, the doctors tell him, that you're never going to walk again, much less wrestle. He asked him, he says, I asked him, am I going to wrestle again? They said, you ain't going to walk, much less wrestle, you know. They didn't sugarcoat it for him. And but him being Harley, but Harley being Harley, he went through a grueling physical therapy, and he makes a full recovery in less than 2 years. And the doctor who did the surgeries on his leg comes and sits ringside when he returns to the ring less than 2 years later. Gosh, a feat of you know, that's just amazing for someone to do that. And you know, his body is so racked and beat up by the time he ends his career. We're having these discussions in 1976, 77, 78, when I ran into him, when we would work together, and I kept asking him questions. And he was telling me all the things that he had were wrong with his body. He's going to end up having a hip and knee replacements. He had multiple abdominal surgeries. And when you look at Harley close, you can see the scars in his stomach. That's from wrestling, some types of bumps. You know, no telling what. If he gets hurt like that in a car wreck, he probably got hurt then these kind of really terrible manner. No telling how those things happened to him. But he's got the knee replacements, the abdominal surgeries. He's got vertebrae that are fused together. And he's got the metal arm in his forearm that they put in when he had the first car wreck. So it's just amazing what he goes through. And then crazy thing happens to him. This has happened to him in 2017, just last year, at the age of 74. He has a fall in his home. He's living in Troy, Missouri. He's gone back to Missouri after he retired, and he's living in the town that basically he grew up in, Troy, Missouri, and he falls in his home, and he breaks both of his legs at the same time. Now, his left leg is so shattered, it's shattered in several places, including the fibia is broke, the tibia is broke, the bone, the big bone and the little bone. He's got a spiral break in his left ankle. They had to give him 4 blood transfusions during surgery to get him through this. And as bad as all that injuries was, now he's got those horrible legs, both legs broken, and one of them is just all shattered and cracked and everything else. And they got to almost knock him out to get him to go to the hospital. He says, I don't need to go to the hospital. Now, how can you be hurt that bad and think you can survive and get over something like that? That's just how tough he was and his thought process. Just amazing.
It's an amazing road from there to the NWA world title.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, some of this, obviously the 2017 injury doesn't happen to him until he's past being world champion. But in 1973, he's going to win the NWA World Championship for the first time from Dory Funk Jr. in Kansas City. That's pretty much same time frame as this match that he and I are having. And he's going to lose it to Jack Briscoe in July of 73 in Houston, Texas, where Paul Bosch is a very famous promoter, one of the greatest promoters of all time. He's going to regain the title again in 1977 from Terry Funk, and he's going to hold the title in for almost 5 years. That's an amazing thing, modern day, to hold that NWA World Championship for that long. He's going to lose it 3 times in short reigns. He's going to lose it to Dusty Rhodes. He's going to lose it to Baba in a trip to Japan. And he's going to lose it to guess who? Tommy Wildfire Rich, who is one of the guests on that Super Stud Cast number 12. Tommy beats him for a world championship, but he regains those championships within days. He loses them and then gets the belt back before he ends up leaving Japan, in the case of Japan, or the territory where I'm sure it's with Dusty, probably in Florida, and obviously it was with Tommy in Georgia, because Tommy becomes a huge star. Barnett loves him, and Tommy becomes the man in Georgia, which is an amazing feat for Tommy. But nonetheless, that's kind of how Harley also won regional titles. I mean, all kinds of championships in North America and in other countries. In Japan, he won their 2 most prestigious titles in Japan when he wasn't world champion, NWA world champion. And he holds the NWA world championship 8 times, which is amazing, amazing feat. And he's one of only 6 wrestlers in history ever to be inducted into the NWA Hall of Fame, the WWE Hall of Fame, the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, and the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. And I think he deserved it. If anyone ever did, knowing how he started, knowing where he came from, knowing the injuries that occurred in his lifetime and what his body was racked with pain. Yeah. I don't know how he walked, much less got in the ring and wrestled. He's just an amazing human being. Yeah. Let's talk about the match. You know, we've talked about pretty much everything else. So let's discuss a little bit about, when Harley became champion, I used to tell the guys in the business, I said, we're going to all be riding Harley Race for a while. And, the reason I used to say that is because so much of all the NWA territory success always depended upon the NWA champion and what he could do for you when he came to town. Or just as important, if not more important, is when he left, How strong would your top babyface be after working with him? That's a critical matter because obviously you don't want the champion to go out of there and have hurt the drawing ability of one of your top stars. And certainly the NWA was famous for that. Their champions were so good at coming in and doing the right type of having the right type of match and leaving the guy looking better than he had before. This match with Harley, I say this match because it was only the fourth time I worked with him and one of eight that I'm going to have with him in my career. I'm going to wrestle Harley Race 8 times in my career. And it was like all the two before. And this match here, it's going to be a fantastic experience for me. Working with Harley was never a copycat match. It'd never be the same every time. A copycat match, I always call them that, is because some guys just seem to have same match again and again and again. But Harley was not like that. You never had a copycat match with him, but you never knew what to expect when you got in the ring with Harley. And that made it interesting. It always made it easier if you don't know what's going to happen. You don't plan things ahead of time. Sometimes you have a better match than if you put a lot of emphasis on the match and you get yourself nerves, your nerves up. That doesn't help you. So you never knew what to expect when you got in the ring with him. That's because he could do it all. I mean, he could wrestle, he could brawl, he could sell, he could make great comebacks, he could do the Broadway. And most importantly, he could make you look great. And we did all those things in this particular match, except for the Broadway. And we did just under an hour and had a great match. Before the match, I was becoming a star in St. Louis. But after this match, I was a star in St. Louis. And that was what the world champions were supposed to do back in those days. And they did such a phenomenal job of it. The NWA world champions, every one of them that I ever worked with. No one did it better than Harley. He's just fantastic at what he did inside that squared circle. He was just amazing to work with and always a pleasure and an honor.
Do you think it would have been possible to have a successful long-term champion in the NWA during the territory years who was a babyface?
Yeah, I think it would have been. I mean, it would have been easier further back. If you went back into the 40s and 50s, I think it would have been easier to have a babyface champion because they did more wrestling. As time went on, I think the business kind of evolved and it started out back in Roy's day, my grandfather's day in the early 20s, 1920s we're talking about, where guys were, matches were all wrestling. And then started to throw a few punches. Then it got a little further and a little further and a further. And, you know, over time, it got to be less wrestling and more of a brawling style. Do you think about it? When you really think about it, Dory Funk Jr. was pretty much one of those type of baby faces. He was a world champion. Obviously, he's wrestling baby faces most of the time. But his matches were probably 90% wrestling. And, you know, so, yeah, I think it could happen. I think it did happen in his case. But that's a great question, you know, because most of the time you want your baby face to wrestle that champion and you want that champion to be a heel. Obviously, you think you're going to draw more money. And I assume you probably do. So it's a great question, though.
Do you have any special Harley stories, any special tales that would be unique to you?
Yeah, I do. I think I have one that this one really always, when I remember Harley, I kind of remember this one the most. And this was a match I had with him, Knoxville, Tennessee, 1977 World Championship match, Civic Coliseum, drew the largest crowd ever to see a sporting event in that arena. Came back actually in the next year and almost matched the crowd identically. The two largest crowds in the history of that building for sports events were wrestling matches, and they were both with me and Harley Race. And in 1977, I wrestled him for the world championship, and Ron Wright comes down to the ringside. I can't remember why he's there. I think he goes and gets the microphone. He's probably knowing Ron Wright, making his hillbilly pitch, and he's telling him he don't deserve this match. My stomper ought to be there, or whatever he's doing out there. And I got out of the ring and went over to him. He had on, for some reason that night, a suit, and I very rarely saw him in a suit. And I was upset because, you know, hey, this is my match. You know, get your butt out of here. You got no place being here. And he started in talking to me about it. And I grabbed him inside his collar with my left hand. And my finger, my mid finger, the finger that you shoot a bird with, let's call it that finger, went down inside his shirt collar. And I was going to rip his collar open. And I broke my finger. In fact, it split and turned sideways at like a 90-degree angle right in the knuckle. So now the match has not even started, and I've got a broken finger. So I reached down and grabbed the finger and tried not to sell it, and I popped it back in place as good as I could, but I could not leave it out because it was still bent some. So I had to tuck it in my palm, and I worked that whole hour match with a broken finger. We went Broadway, had a tremendous match. One of those matches that just builds your town. It made the territory. It just was a phenomenal night. All the matches that night were just spectacular. And the last one was the best of all. And so after the match, I went back to the dressing room, and it took a while to get dressed. I patched up my finger as best I could. I never got it put back in, never put a splint on it, but even I just, you know, straightened it up a little more as good as I could. And then I told the guy that ran the company for me, that handled the box office, I said, I want you to bring me Harley's payoff. And he asked me what the figure was, and he brought it back to me. And as that, you know, matches are over, and they've been over for 30 minutes or more, and I'm still in the dressing room, the dressing rooms are separated. And he gives me the money. I tell him how much money I want. I'm going to pay him. First, I ask what the house is. The house is the biggest house ever drawn in that building. So he brings me back his payoff. And I walk across behind there's an area that there was a hallway that you could get into the Heels dressing room. I'd never been in the Heels dressing room. And I went in there, and it's just Harley. And we sat down, talked a little bit about the match. He said, I realize you had your finger broke. You broke your finger, didn't you? I said, yeah, I did. When I grabbed his collar, I broke my finger before we ever started. And so he was, you know, hey, well, it was a hell of a match considering, and, you know, you broke your finger before it even began. And then I said, Harley, I want to pay you personally. And I think he was really respectful of that. I think he really liked it. So he put his hand out. And I remember looking at his face. I had $100 bills. And I started counting out the $100 bills. I got to 1,000, 10 of them. And he looked up at me. And he didn't smile or anything. He just looked up at me. And I kept counting them, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, up to $2,000. He just kind of shook his head when I got all of it in there. He's sitting there with a palm full of hundreds, and he shook his head, and he said, you know, Ron, he goes, you can call Sam Muchnick and for me, he said, and tell him that I said that I would work for you any time that I possibly could. Put me in Knoxville as often as you could. I was like, wow, Harley, and that was a really great statement. And I don't know how much $2,000 is in today's money, but, you know, it was a pretty darn good payoff. It's all cash. And, you know, Harley was just, he was, gosh, just marvelous. He was always marvelous to me. But after that particular night, and then he came back several more times and did work that building again, do almost identical crowds, and got paid same type of money. And it was just a little special moment. And after that, I started every time I had a world champion that wrestled for me, I went and made their payoff personally. I felt like it was just a good way to do business.
You've had other injuries in the ring, more severe, I'm sure, than that. But how painful is it to get through a match with a broken finger?
Oh, it's really difficult. You don't think about how hard it is, but you can't. And you can't bend. You can only bend that finger so far into your palm. And what I did is everything I did that night, I had to do it based around that finger being in the wrong place in my palm of my hand. It made it hard for arm drags. It made it hard for slams. It made it hard for suplexes. And it just made it a difficult, a lot more difficult match. And I kept thinking, you know, maybe I could have had an even better match if I hadn't have broke that finger. But it didn't stop me. I mean, I was so just blown away by the crowd. And that night, I'll never forget the audience. The crowd itself was just so fantastic and so into it. And we went the whole hour. I asked him for five more, and he would not come back. And I would have done another five with him. I wasn't going to beat him, obviously. But, you know, it was a great, great night for me. I walked away with a broken finger, but I probably made – it was one of the best nights of my life for what I made that night as well. And to see, like I said, we built the town that match. I had for years and years after that match, hundreds of people at least come up to me and say, that was the greatest wrestling match I ever saw in my life. And I always took a real pleasure in hearing that. It was a tremendous compliment and, just a fabulous, fabulous evening, and cannot say enough about Harley Race and what he meant to the sport of wrestling.
As we wrap things up, we want to remind you, you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. All you have to do is go to the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Just like that page and you're automatically friends with the Tennessee Stud. Of course, you can follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts, classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor, the 605 Super Podcast. Don't forget the hilarious new Super Studcast number 12 with Tommy Wildfire Rich and Cousin Johnny Crash Rich, available right now at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast only. $2.99. I guarantee you'll like this. Tommy with a stellar performance on the Super Studcast this time. Check that out. You will definitely enjoy it. But Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we've wrestled some real stars today, and we're in 1974. There's a lot of tremendous wrestlers in America, and we're going to experience some more of them next week. We're going to be talking about my first experience with Bobo Brazil, Stan Vachon, and Tex McKenzie, who is just about my size and very similar to me in a whole lot of ways. I'm going to have another match with Harley Race. I think we'll be able to get that in next week. And we're going to start laying the groundwork for the biggest angle that's ever going to happen in Florida wrestling history when they turn Dusty Rhodes. That's going to happen in 1974. It's a tremendous time for wrestling in America. In 1974, in the entire 70s, and I'm certainly looking forward to it.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.